You're listening to the Greatest Multifamily Investment Advice Show. My name is Adam Ross, and now I'm talking everything multifamily for an in-depth conversation, and I will be diving deep into raising capital, deals, and underwriting process. Welcome back to the Greatest Multifamily Advice Show. Today we have Neil Bao, real estate investor, syndicator, with amazing journey in raising capital, public speaker, and marketing mogul, focusing on multifamily real estate investment. Please help me to welcome our guest today. How are you, Neil?
Fantastic, Adam. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks a lot. I would like to start with the beginnings from Silicon Valley to multifamily. What was the beginning for you?
Well, I'm a data nerd. I'm a geek, computer science degree, data scientist background. You know, the typical tech career, working 70 hours a week, doing the rat race and doing it for a while. Did it basically from 1999 to 2013 when I was able to sell my technology company. I was a partner in a company. And during that time, because I live in Taxifornia and I was paying 52% a year in taxes, I became aware of the benefits of real estate when it comes to depreciation and tax avoidance, and it really, you know, started playing with it myself over that time frame between 2008 and 2014. I did real estate for my own personal portfolio for about 6 years, and during that time I started also teaching others about data science and real estate. I think I must have presented at hundreds of meetups during that time, podcasts, also some conferences, and people would always say, hey, why aren't you in real estate? What do you sell? And the answer is, no, I'm in technology. I don't have anything to sell. I just do this for myself, and I share my data science. And more people would come to me and say, if you ever do this, we'd love to work with you. So eventually I ended up with a big database that I'd never used. And so once I sold my company, I tried to retire. That was very boring. So I switched over into real estate full time and, you know, thought of it as something that I would engage in and do a little bit of a hobby, maybe even grow my own portfolio. And I mean, it just sort of snowballed. We went from, you know, one project to 31 projects. You know, we invested in 17 metro areas. We have well over 800 active investors that have invested in our projects. The portfolio is just about at $1 billion at this point. And it really snowballed because of this desire to apply technology and data science to real estate. That's really, you know, that describes everything that we do. So I can talk for the next 2 hours, but it will come back to this one statement. We apply data science to real estate.
How?
So there's hundreds of different ways of doing it, right? So there's tons and tons and tons of different ways of doing it. The first and most obvious way of doing it is you basically take a database of every city and every corridor and every state in the United States.
Yeah.
And you basically create probabilistic measurements that show which city is going to have the highest increases in home prices. Now you might say, you know, oh, you're in multifamily. What does that have to do with home prices? So my research over the last, you know, from 2008 to now, so about 14 years of research, showed that there is an extraordinarily strong correlation between single family home price increases and multifamily rent increases 12 months later. 12 months later, right? So home prices go up first. So basically we have in multifamily, we have a crystal ball, and that crystal ball is called home price increases, right? So now we have 12 months to immediately get into the market now because we're about to see a massive increase in rent prices as homes go up. And so I became very obsessed with the idea of tracking the probability of home price increases in markets. And then I realized that a lot of people knew about those in larger markets, you know, whether it's Phoenix or Austin or you know, there's some of the big markets, Atlanta, you know, obviously California, New York, but nobody knew anything about home price increases in smaller markets. People did not understand them. Like, for example, people will come onto Adam's show and say things like, Tucson is a great market. And then they will say, Jacksonville is a great market, right? And then they'll say, San Antonio is a great market. I don't say that because it means nothing. They're all great markets, but it's possible that Jacksonville this year will have 10% home price increases, San Antonio will have 20, and Tucson will have 30. Now, technically, the person said what he said was right, because any market that has a 10% home price increase is a great market. And if you invest in multifamily in that market, you will do well in the future.
Correct.
But did you see the difference? 10%, 20%, and 30%. So one of those three markets was three times better than the other market, even though all three were great.
Yes.
My obsession is about figuring out exactly which ones are the best. And I don't particularly care about the size of the market, simply because the smaller markets tend to have faster growth and they have more yield. And I understand that there's a higher risk there, but I have told my investors that I am managing that risk for them. So my investors are okay with investing in markets that most of your listeners haven't even heard of, right? So, people have given me massive amounts of money to build in Washington, Utah, which is a city of 22,000 people, yeah, or Idaho Falls, which is a metro of 110,000 people, because the data science said those cities are so strong that they were protected from a recession, that we wouldn't lose money, right? We would probably make, you know, wouldn't make money if there was a very harsh recession during the time that we were building or owning there. But the upside was phenomenal. And so we've been able to, on seven exits, do 36 IRR over 40% annualized returns because we followed the data science and went to places that most people are terrified to go to.
So I think what you're saying is making sense, because me personally, for example, I look on CPRE, M&M, maybe other websites. The focus always on this report is about the major markets on like, for example, Nashville and Memphis. But no one is talking about anything else than this on Tennessee. When you're talking about North Carolina, it's only Charlotte.
And Raleigh.
Yeah, but other markets, nothing. Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Like, Asheville is an incredible market. So is Winston-Salem. But how many people at conferences ever talk about Asheville or Winston-Salem? There's actually some markets smaller than Asheville and Winston-Salem in North Carolina that are better markets than even Asheville. And Asheville is the third largest market. So in almost every state except for Texas, people just stop at the top two, right? If it's Georgia, it's just Atlanta. If it's Texas, it's Dallas and Austin, maybe Houston. But what about smaller markets like New Braunfels and San Marcos and Killeen and Fredericksburg? Are the best markets in Texas?
I never heard
of
them.
Are the best markets in Texas, right?
Yeah.
Period. Simply because there aren't 300 people trying to buy every goddamn building in Killeen.
100%. Agree. But how you manage to create this, like me personally as a syndicator, I look on CPRE and MMM, but how you manage to have a system to get this result? But
CBRE has no interest in these markets, right?
Yeah.
So CBRE, what is CBRE trying to do? They're trying to convince the syndicators. They're trying to convince Adam Rass to read their document and then go bid on a property in Atlanta, because the property in Atlanta on a price per door basis is probably, you know, twice as high as some of the places that I'm bidding on. So obviously CBRE wants you to stay in these main markets and bid up the properties as much as possible. So there's 20 of you trying to kill each other buying one property. That's CBRE's goal. That's Marcus and Millichap's goal. So why the hell would they list these smaller properties? The short answer is I don't know of any, you know, paid data sources. Same thing with CoStar. CoStar doesn't really give you enough data on these smaller markets, though they do. They're better than some of these others.
Yeah.
So you can get decent data in these smaller markets from CoStar.
Yeah.
So one is, sure, look at CoStar. The second is build your own database. And that's why I tell people I am not in the real estate business. I'm in the business of disruptive technology, of big data, of data science. Right? So the answer is you build it yourself. So we spider data throughout the web. We grab the data from lots and lots of different sources. We pay for sources. So there's data sources that we pay for. Neighborhood Scout for a neighborhood level, you know, a local market monitor for a national level, and many others. So what we do is we take data from many different sources. We clean it, right, to make sure that the edge data, the bad data is cleaned out.
Yeah.
And then what we do is we create our own benchmarks based on our investing philosophy. We create both fundamentals and momentum-based benchmarks. So fundamentals investing is like Warren Buffett. You know, he buys stocks when they're cheap, right?
Yeah.
Momentum investing is like, what's her name, Kathy, whatever, you know, buying technology stocks because she knows that they're going to go up. And when they go up and they're about to come down, then she sells them. So there's a lot of people people doing momentum investing. So we assign both momentum scores and fundamental scores. And we try to look for small markets that are fundamentally strong, but momentum-wise are extremely strong. So momentum in the end beats, you know, fundamentals. So we want the underlying fundamentals to be strong so that if there is a crash, we won't lose money. We probably won't make money.
Yeah.
And then we want extraordinary momentum in those markets. So momentum can be tracked in lots of different ways: population growth, home price growth, income growth, job growth, crime reduction. You know, all of those are ways of figuring out what the momentum of a market is. Mm. But we want the underlying fundamentals to be pretty strong. So right now, oddly enough, one of the top markets in the United States is Rogers, Arkansas. And no one has ever, goddamn it, heard of Rogers, Arkansas. You might have heard of Little Rock, where Walmart is, but nobody's heard of Rogers, Arkansas. But I know that market is extraordinarily strong. If you go into that market at this point of time, the chances that you lose money are very, very low, right? And I don't particularly like Arkansas. It is not a popular state. In my list of favorite states, Arkansas is nowhere in the top 20, right? And there's only 50 states in the country, but the market is incredible, right? So these phenomena occur on a daily basis. No one knows that they occur. They're extraordinarily powerful. And this is why there is no data science in real estate. I think CoStar is the best example of the use of data science in real estate, and they're pretty expensive. Yeah. But I think that you can actually do more than that. And even CoStar has a very strong bias towards major metros. Because you know their biggest audience are people that have billions of dollars to invest. Yeah. So obviously they want the lowest level of risk, right? And my investors are okay with not being at that lowest level of risk. They know that I'm using cutting edge data science, and if they invest in enough of my projects, I'll make it up. So a lot of my investors are invested in 5, 6, 7, 10 projects, right? I've done 31 of them. So I think that when you even it out, you can see the track record on the homepage of my website. You know, you can't really hide track records. And some of the, I'm very keenly aware that a substantial portion of my track record, let's say 1/3 of my returns, are because of the all ships rising effect that we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years. Everybody's returns were, you know, raised by that. But in my case, though, the all ships rising effect has been stronger than it has been for others because of my obsession with, I don't want to go to a great metro. I just want to know how great, right? And I want to be able to measure every single metro and figure out which ones are the great test and go invest in them and never touch the hottest metros because there's too many people like Adam running around trying to buy property in there. Go to the ones that are one level below but are still the hottest.
Yeah, so market fundamentals have to be strong to have a bulletproof plan during the recession. I like this. So the whole goal is to keep your...
It is a small market though. So keep in mind, I mean, I don't want to overplay this. I don't want to bullshit anybody, right? So smaller markets get hit stronger during recessions.
Yeah.
So the goal is that if there is a recession like 2008, not the sort of recession we're about to get, by the way, the US is going to enter into a recession, I think, in the next 12 months.
Yeah.
So, but those are forced recessions. The Fed is forcing us into a recession to slow inflation down. They've done it many times before in the last 60 years, 9 times actually. Yeah. So those kinds of recessions tend to be shallow because the Fed basically stops pounding the economy right before they're about to enter into inflation, making the inflation shallow, and then they support it on the way back up. So you know, bottom line is that if there was a 2008 type recession, I want to make sure that the market that I'm in doesn't lose investor money. Right. Yes. It's not right. So if there was that kind of 2008 recession, and if you were in like a place like Phoenix or Austin, you know, super strong markets, you'd probably do better than me because, you know, my market's going to get hit harder than Austin would. Right. But on the upside, I can make more money than you can in Austin if the market is reasonable or it's not a 2008 type recession. So that's really what what my investors are after.
Medium risk.
Yeah, absolutely. So I completely describe myself as, look, I'm a medium risk investor. Please do not think of me as the guy that takes the least amount of risk or is the most conservative. I can refer you to a bunch of people that I think are more conservative than me. And if that's your risk profile, go with them, right?
Yeah.
If your profile is, to use data science to minimize the risk, but not make it, you know, minimal risk, then I'm a great syndicator
I'm
to
your
work
guy.
With. So I'm absolutely your guy.
So what is the major upside of your markets?
Say that again.
What is the major upside of your markets?
The short answer is the vast majority of syndicators are not chasing products there, so the product doesn't get bid up as much. So whether it's value add or new construction. The other piece of it is I have some very unique ways of building new construction product at much lower than other people's costs. So secret, let's call it my secret sauce. And so I'm able to build product that even in today's market, and this is what I'm about to say is not an exaggeration. In today's market, with shockingly high interest rates, I have investors that even with those interest rates are outperforming the marketplace. One, less competition. Second, ability to build at much lower, you know, costs per door, per square foot. And third, that market was selected for extraordinary job growth, home price growth, population growth, and income growth. Those are the four that I tend to focus on the most. And so it already had massive tailwinds.
So you mentioned something now that you have a diverse portfolio. So what is more you're leaning to, buy and hold or pre-development and development projects or both?
So 70% of my portfolio is some kind of development, and it's five or six different kinds of developments. I do modular developments where I build off-site and basically ship it to the site. I do student housing developments. I do fourplex development. I do townhome for sale development. So many different kinds of developments is about 70% of my portfolio. The remaining 30% of my portfolio is value add and super value add. I'm the only super value add syndicator in the US. No one else has ever completed multiple super value add projects.
Can we focus on this part? What is a super value add, you mean?
Sure. Super value add
is
a strategy where you work with the city, the city officials, to increase the number of units in the property that you've already purchased, so a value add property that you purchased, and then build more units. Because if you build 20% more units, you get 50% increase in NOI. A 50% increase in NOI is a 50% increase in the selling price of the property, right? Because selling price for multifamily is cap rate multiplied by NOI. So if NOI goes up 50%, price goes up 50%. Yep. You might say, how can 20% of the units make the price go up by 50%? Well, because none of your other costs change, right? You don't add more property managers. You know, even your in many cases, your property taxes don't reset because the property square footage doesn't increase. Not always. Most of the time, it doesn't. And even if it does, it won't reset for a number of years. So all of that money that's coming in is going straight to cash flow. Your land is free because you're building inside your own property. Yep. Your parking is free. And your utilities are free because they're already inside the property, right? So most people don't know this, but horizontal construction costs a great deal of money before you even go vertical, right? And a lot of that work is now done for you because you're building inside your own property by convincing the city to add more units. So we've done two super value add projects. One was in Arkansas, and the other one was in Georgia, and both exited at explosive returns.
So when you're approaching the municipalities about this, what was the target plan here to convince the municipality is providing more?
You can firstly upzone the property. So let's say that they had a 24 unit per acre zoning, which is pretty common for multifamily. You can convince them to go up to 30 units an acre or 36 units an acre. Second, if you're lucky enough and you know how exactly to do it, this requires a full-time person, by the way. So I have a person who only does this. Is that every time you look at a value add property that comes to the market, and we look at about 85 a week. So we all in, we receive 4,000 properties per year.
Yeah.
And so when you're looking at them early on, if obviously it's not a good area, then you reject it that way. But if it's a good area and the numbers are not working and you really like the property, then you basically start this process of calling the city to determine And this works, by the way, for 80s property. It does not work for a newer property than that. But in the 80s, land was so cheap in the United States that sometimes people would build less units than they could simply because some of the units were on a slope. So on a slope in the 80s, they were like, oh, this is going to cost me $20,000 per unit. I'm just going to leave those as kind of walking areas and trails and things like that. What today, firstly, the cost of building on slopes has dropped because we have more machinery and more technology on
Makes
how to
sense.
cut them. And second, the land has become so expensive. Zoned land has become so expensive. And remember, by default, the property is already zoned multifamily. So you don't have to zone it, right? So now people like me can go and build on that additional space, right? Even if it's sloped. So the economics have changed because back in the 80s when properties were being built, they were building them at $60,000 to $70,000 a unit. We're now building at $250,000 a unit. So the economics are different. So super value add basically allows us to engage cities and then engage our development division. The reason that no syndicator has done it in the US is you need a full-size development team, and you'd never be able to make the financials work based on super value add because you're only doing 20 or 30 units, and you can't hire a development team to do 30 units. Luckily, I'm a developer. I have 1,500 units under development. So that same development team that builds my 1,500 units also as a side gig is doing these 30 or 40 units in the super value adds.
Okay, this makes sense. This was basically my next question is how you managed to partner with a developer, but you're saying that you have your own team already.
No, we don't partner. We are a developer. We are a full stack developer with an in-house development team.
So as you mentioned, it's 70% on MicroStrategies or a big project. So you do mainly MicroStrategies when you split acres or land to small lots or mainly on a big project like townhouses and so on.
All of them really. So we just decided not to exit a project because the interest rates went up, but it was selling at about 34% IRR, and that was just a regular apartment complex that we built in Utah. It was 115 units on 5 acres, so just very middle of the road. Same thing with the Grid, which we built a 210 unit student housing facility in Buffalo. And then we do some very exotic stuff like fourplex townhomes, almost 35, 40 units to an acre. And those can be built in the middle of cities. So we build both large, very dense projects in the middle of cities, and then we also build less dense projects on the outskirt of cities where the land is cheaper. So
100%.
we just we're right now leasing up a townhome project that's only 12 units to an acre. So it's low density. Whereas we have another unit in project in construction in Houston called Park Lane, which is 40 units an acre. So that's, the answer is I do fairly large projects on very tiny pieces of land, and I also do fairly large projects on pretty big pieces of land. It just depends on the city and on what the cost of the land is.
But the strength here is you have your own development team. He studies the actual municipality requirement and they play on this.
Yes, a bunch of people, right? So we've got an entire set. So we have one full-time employee just looking for land, right? So her job is just constantly 8 hours a day, call every single broker in the US and look for land. And then we have one person whose job is to just take a look at land, make offers, put it into contract for 9 months, and then figure out if we can zone it, right? So that person's job is to zone it. And then we have one person that takes it from zoning all the way to pre-construction. And then we have a team that takes it from pre-construction all the way to the end of construction. And then we have a dedicated leasing team that leases them up. So five separate teams on the development side.
So my final or fun question within between 2014 to now is almost 8 years. How do you define your superpower?
My biggest superpower is simply this: I'm obsessed with the use of technology to accelerate returns. So my company currently uses over 600 automations. 600 automations. We have built an internal team in the Philippines of 22 employees, all full-time, all working our time. So they all work Pacific Standard Time. And so we combine that 22-person virtual assistant team with a 137 software stack to create massive efficiency and scale. And that scale allows us to both raise money. Almost, there's one company in our space that raises it faster than us. They're better known than us. But we are the second best at raising money. We've raised $250,000 in the last 4 years, last 3 years. So basically $250 million, so yeah. 250 million.
Yeah.
And then we have the ability to deliver a very large number of projects at the same time. So at this point, there are 7 projects delivering on the construction pipeline. The value add is running on 5 projects, some close to completion, some that have just been purchased, and then super value add is running on 1.
Your weaknesses?
I think the biggest weakness is that I, because I'm so tied to data, I lose the advantages that people have of building relationships in one metro. So there are companies that I've given money to as a passive investor, Nitya Capital, for example, they're in Houston. They've built an empire in Houston. They went deeper and deeper and deeper into Houston. And now anybody that sells a building in Houston knows to call them first before putting it on market because they'll give you a competitive price. And I think that is something that we lack. We are in 17 metros. We have roots, but we don't have the depth of the roots, and that's really our weakness. We don't have that depth of knowledge and connections in any one metro in the US.
Do you prefer to do this? Do you prefer to be just to come on just one metro?
No, because I find that I would not be true to myself. You know, to be true to myself, I have to be able to make this statement. There is no best metro in the US. There's only a best metro this year. And a best metro next year. And it's never the same, right? Austin has been in the top 3 in the last 6 years. So it's a phenomenal metro. And I have a lot of projects, not in Austin, around Austin. Remember the strategy?
Yeah, 100%.
But even then, I know that Austin's not number one most years, right? So some years Phoenix will beat it, some years Tampa will beat it. Something will always beat it. And so for me to pick, say I'm just going to be an Austin developer, then am I a data scientist? I don't think so.
Makes sense. My last question would be, how is it people can follow your success?
So I think following success is not as important as following our data, because every one of you has the capability of being successful if you have data. We live in the age of technology where data that used to cost $25,000 a year in the 80s is now available for $40 a month. So I don't think that you should follow our success. I think you should follow our data. And the best way to do that is simply Google my first and last name. I'm the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web. So N-E-A-L space Bawa. And then you can add a word that you're interested in. I would suggest a few words that you can add. For example, Neil Bawa Virtual Assistants will show you how I build offshore teams with step-by-step instructions. Neil Bawa Build-to-Rent will show you why I'm more bullish on the build-to-rent asset class than multifamily. Yeah. Neil Bawa, what else? Neil Bawa Location Magic would tell you how I select cities. So the process of city selection. And there's many others. If you really like the data science, you can go and see all of it at multifamily followed by the letter U.com. So multifamilyu.com, we've had 175,000 registrations for our data webinars. And in a typical year, we have about 30 to 40,000 people that attend our webinars. They are very data-driven. They're very nerdy. But hey, one comment that I'd like to leave you with is this. So the Bible got it wrong by one letter. It is not the meek that shall inherit the earth. It's the geek.
Okay.
It's the geek.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for being with us today. And really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me on, Adam. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.